Edinburgh, with the General Secretary of Churches Together in Britain and Ireland, the Reverend Bob Fyfe. Here on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week, Michael Maloney reads the final episode of 1913, The Year Before the Storm, by Florian Illies.
In mid-November, the fun-loving Countess of Schwerin-Lowitz, wife of the President of the State Parliament, or Landtag, issues an invitation to a tango tea dance in the Prussian Landtag. On the floor, dancers in a close embrace with dignitaries and serious military officers. Kaiser Wilhelm II, who finds the tango vulgar, cracks down. On the 20th of November, an imperial bill is passed, henceforth banning officers in uniform from dancing the tango. In the Minerva Hall in Trieste, the southernmost harbour city of Austria-Hungary, James Joyce delivers a series of lectures on Hamlet. He has previously tried to make some money by opening a cinema in Dublin and toyed with the idea of importing tweed from Ireland to Italy. But it came to nothing. His attempts to earn money with his books have been a disaster too. Now he is scraping a living as an English teacher in the morning, and in the afternoon he gives private lessons, notably to the future author Italo Svevo. And in the evening he talks about Hamlet. The local newspaper, Piccolo della Sera, is enthusiastic, with its dense but clear thoughts, with a format once sublime and simple, with its wit and vividness, the lecture revealed genuine brilliance. In November, Franz Ferdinand is pheasant shooting with King George V near Windsor Castle. The Archduke and the King are accompanied by three English earls, while the ladies chat in Windsor Castle and listen to concerts. On Tuesday, 1,000 pheasants and 450 wild ducks are brought down by the marksmen after being driven into the line of fire by beaters. On Wednesday, in the loveliest sunshine, they shoot 1,700 pheasants. On Thursday, they shoot about 1,000. And then on Friday, with rain lashing the faces of the royal hunting party, 800 pheasants and 800 wild ducks are slaughtered. A bloodbath. Marcel Duchamp still doesn't feel like making art, but he has an idea. Can one, he wonders, create works that are not artworks? And then, in the autumn, in his new flat on Rue Saint-Hippolyte in Paris, the front wheel of a bicycle appears, and he mounts it on a kitchen stool. Duchamp says, "It was something I wanted to have in my room, the way one has a fireplace or a pencil sharpener, except that it was not in any way useful. It's a pleasant device, pleasant because of the movements it made." Duchamp finds it calming to spin the wheel with his hand. He likes its endless rotation on its own axis. While in Paris and Berlin and Moscow, artists are still fighting about whether cubism, realism, expressionism, or abstraction is the royal road. The young Duchamp just puts a bicycle wheel in his kitchen and creates the first ready-made. There has been no trace of the Mona Lisa since she was stolen from the Louvre 2 years ago. But at the beginning of December, the Florentine art dealer Alfredo Geri receives a letter. This portly, broad-shouldered and gregarious gentleman caters to Florence's upper classes from his antique shop in Via Borgo Ognissanti. The letter he is holding in his hands disturbs him. Is it the truth, or simply a letter from a lunatic? It reads, "The stolen painting by Leonardo da Vinci is in my possession. It is quite clear that it belongs to Italy, because the painter was Italian. It is my desire to give this masterpiece back to the country it came from and by which it was inspired. Leonardo." Geri arranges a meeting with the sender for December 22nd in Milan. But on the 10th of December, when Jerry is about to close up his shop, a man comes up and says, "My name is Leonardo." He had, the man told Jerry, come a little earlier after all, and was staying at the Albergo Tripoli Italia in Via Panzani under the name of Leonardo Vincenzo. In other words, just one block away from Borgo San Lorenzo, where 400 years earlier, Lisa del Giocondo had sat and modelled for Leonardo. Leonardo went on to say that Signore Jerry could come to see the Mona Lisa in the guest house at 3 in the afternoon the following day. Jerry subsequently alerts the director of the Uffizi Gallery, Giovanni Poggi, and the next day the three of them go from the antique shop to the run-down guest house. As they walk through the streets, Jerry and Leonardo agree that he will receive 500,000 lira if the painting is genuine. "That would be nice," Leonardo says, "but it really isn't about the money. He just wants to bring Italy's stolen art treasure back home." The gentlemen climb up the steep steps to the Albergo Tripoli Italia, where Leonardo's shabby single room is situated on the second floor. He fetches a trunk out from under the bed, throwing its entire contents onto the mattress. Then he opens a false bottom inside the trunk and takes out a board wrapped in red silk. "Before our eyes, the divine Gioconda appeared, unharmed and in magnificent condition," says Jerry. There is no doubt. The inventory number from the Louvre is even on the back. But despite their excitement, Jerry and Poggi keep their nerve. They tell Leonardo that the painting may be the one everyone's looking for, but that they have to make further inquiries. Leonardo, exhausted from the long journey and with the 500,000 lira in his sights, lies down for an afternoon nap. Poggi immediately informs the police. When the carabinieri open the door, Leonardo is still asleep. He does not resist arrest. The Mona Lisa is taken to the Uffizi under police protection. Aware of the significance of his find, Poggi doesn't just call the culture minister, Corrado Ricci in Rome, and the French ambassador, Camille Barrère, but even has his calls put through to King Vittorio Emanuele and Pope Pius X. In the Italian parliament, two representatives are exchanging blows when someone runs into the plenary hall and cries out, "La Gioconda è trovata!" The message is immediately understood. The two adversaries embrace and kiss each other. From this moment on, the whole of Italy is overcome by Mona Lisa fever. And Leonardo. Leonardo's real name is Vincenzo Perugia. He is 32 years old and was working as a temporary glazier in the Louvre at the time of the theft. It was he who had put the Mona Lisa in its glass frame. And because he had put her there, he knew how to get her out. He hid himself one evening so that he would be locked in, took the painting out, wrapped it in linen, and then walked out of the Louvre the next morning in broad daylight. The guards, who knew him well, nodded to him in greeting. The whole story is absurd. The police took fingerprints from everyone, every cleaning woman, every art historian, every archivist in the Louvre, in order to catch the thief, because he'd left prints on the picture's frame. But they forgot the temporary glazier Vincenzo Perugia. During their search for the Mona Lisa, the police had even visited him at home in his little room at 5 Rue de l'Hôpital Saint-Louis, just like they had every other Louvre staff member. But the police didn't look under the bed. There, just a kilometre away from the Louvre as the crow flies, the most hunted artwork in the world lay, for 2 whole years. The Italian culture minister Ricci says, "I just wish the French had declared the picture to be a copy, for then Mona Lisa would stay in Italy." But the French declare the painting to be the original. Alfredo Geri is given a reward by the Louvre and the rosette of the Légion d'honneur by the French state. Vincenzo Perugia is sentenced to 7 months imprisonment. Ezra Pound, the great poet and one of London's most important and proactive cultural mediators, sends a letter to James Joyce in Trieste. He asks the poverty-stricken English teacher for some of his newest poems for the magazine The Egoist. This letter makes Joyce feel as if he has been raised from the dead. Soon, Pound sends a second letter from his Kensington home saying that Yeats has sent him Joyce's poem I Hear an Army and that he liked it very much. So emboldened is Joyce that he sits down that very day and corrects his two manuscripts. After 2 weeks, the first chapter of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and his short stories Dubliners are ready, and he sends them by express train to Ezra Pound in London. Phyllis Bauer is no longer returning Kafka's letters. He writes to her by registered post. He writes to her by special delivery. He even sends his friend Ernst Weiss with a message, but she doesn't answer. In Babylon, the temple site of Etemenanki is discovered. It is the legendary Tower of Babel. On the 14th of December, watched over by a unique international honor guard consisting of gendarme and carabinieri in parade uniform, the Mona Lisa is hung in the Uffizi, carried through the walkways in an elaborate gilded walnut frame. 30,000 people see her. Italian children get a day off school to go to Florence and admire the national shrine. Then, on the 20th of December, the painting is taken to King Vittorio Emanuele in Rome in a saloon carriage filled with guests. The next day, he hands it over to the French in their embassy, the Palazzo Farnese. Over Christmas, the painting is on display in the Villa Borghese. At night, a dozen police officers stand guard. Next, the Mona Lisa is taken to Milan, where the painting is on display in the Brera Museum for 2 days. Mona Lisa's journey through Italy is an unparalleled victory parade. Whenever the carriage passes a train station, people cheer and wave. The Mona Lisa is given a private carriage in the express train from Milan to Paris. She is treated like a queen. Late in the evening of New Year's Eve, the Mona Lisa crosses the French border. In issue 52, Welt der Frau, a supplement of Gartenlaube, provides tips for fashion at the turn of the year. On the following page, there is a poem by Marie Mola, which bears the title New Year's Eve. So let us work from dawn till dusk, that a fine year may us befall, bringing after strife and toil, victory and peace to all. And that the tune of global war may cease its gloomy threatening knell, that it may soon in harmony ring out like joyful, charming bells.
The Year Before the Storm was written by Florian Illies and translated by Sean Whiteside and Jamie Lee Searle. It was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Michael Maloney. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. We'll stick with 1913 for Woman's Hour. That's after the news, which is after this look ahead to next week.
Hello, I'm Peter Day, back soon with a new series of In Business. It's a programme that likes to lean into the future. So this summer I'll be reporting on, among other things, the uncertain outlook for China, high-tech in Africa, the lure of the seaside in 21st century Britain, and what happens when nearly everything we use is connected to the internet. But we start next Thursday with a potent question. The headlines are full of the potential of this thing called fracking, so whatever happened to North Sea oil? That's In Business next Thursday evening at 8:30.